All right, we are at 6:06 p.m. Sorry for the late start. We had a lively discussion here earlier, so glad y'all could participate in that. So I would like to call this meeting to order. All right, Amber, can I get a roll call?
Ruben and Joe are out today.
Yep.
It looks like I do not see either. Oh, Simone just came on. Hi, Simone. I do not see Kim Harless. Everyone else?
She'll be there. She'll be coming late.
Okay.
So if her participation was needed for the approval or quorum, suggesting that be a later item.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, it looks like we do have a quorum. So if Kim is coming later, we're all good, but we still have a quorum as of right now.
All right. So we have two sets of meeting agenda minutes to approve, and we do have a quorum, so I would suggest we're in November, so we have to go back to, will you help me?
August 3rd,
yep.
And June 1st.
All right. So I'll start with June 1st. Do we have a motion to approve the June 1st meeting minutes as they are written?
I'll make a motion. The
meeting
minutes as written.
Perfect. All right, we have a first and a second. All in favor? Any opposed? All right, that passes. Then we're going to move on to the August 3rd meeting minutes. We get a motion to approve as written.
I'll move. Accept the minutes for August 3rd as written.
Second.
All right, we have a motion to approve in a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? No? All right, that carries. First, before we get started, I would like to welcome Jerry to the group. And if Joelle.
Yeah, so we wanted to introduce you. We have Jerry Preston, who is our new Environmental Public Health Director. He wasn't able to be here in person tonight, but he's here virtually. So I wanted to just give Jerry an opportunity to introduce himself, maybe give a little bit of your background.
Sure. Hi, everyone. It's nice to meet you. Just a very brief background. I worked for the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality for over 20 years in air quality, underground storage tank, and solid waste management, recycling, composting. We did permitting and inspections of landfills, transfer stations.
Are you there, Jerry?
Okay.
All right. Well, I think we lost Jerry for the moment, but definitely welcome aboard. We're happy to have you here. Moving on to number two, presentation on composting workshops. Pete, you're up, bud.
Hey, everyone. Welcome. Appreciate the time. I don't know if this will go the full 30 minutes, but I did prepare a PowerPoint, and feel free to jump in anytime with questions. Again, I'm Pete Dubois, and I'm with the Solid Waste Environmental Outreach team. We've got four main programs. One of those is the Composter Recycler Program, formerly the Master Composter Recycler Program, and we do a lot of outreach in the community, and one of those areas is our fall workshop series. And so this is good timing. We're halfway through the workshop series, and I will share my slides and run through some of that for you so you can see what we are up to. And I appreciate the opportunity. I appreciate everyone showing up on a Thursday night. Beautiful day here in Pacific Northwest. Sometimes we need to remind ourselves we live in one of the most beautiful places around. So we're very fortunate to be here in Clark County. We've also got a great maritime climate. So we definitely have opportunities almost year round to be outdoors. And some of this entails being outdoors, but our primary focus with our fall community workshop series is really focusing on food waste. And of course, you all are familiar with Washington State, the organics management law, which is a very aggressive law to cut organics going into the landfill by 75% by 2030. And big chunk of that, of course, is food waste. The goal is to cut that food waste in half. And we'll talk a little bit about what that means. But when we do these workshops, we typically give an overview. We take for granted the solid waste system. We're garbage geeks. I think most of us could geek out on this. But folks don't really know what a landfill is. They think maybe it's still back in the day where the seagulls and the rats and just the stuff kind of thrown in a big pit. But these are very engineered these days. They only have a certain area open. That material is covered every day. And then we get methane as a result because it's an anaerobic kind of giant stomach like a cow in some respects. And with that, our landfills are the third largest source of human-related methane emissions. And so that was one of the drivers around greenhouse gases and other things for the state legislature to pass this law. And keeping food waste out is one of those main components to try to minimize that. But we also can put our food to much better use. It's a new graphic by the EPA. Obviously, we don't want to make the waste in the first place. An average household really just in this country, USA, throws away about $1,800 worth of food every year. They say you go to the store, come back with three bags. One of those bags goes right in the trash. And so really, we do work on some of that. We're also looking at the compost component here through our home composting programs. And then finally, we want to do what we can to give people an opportunity with the goal of zero food waste into our trash cans. And we are talking lots of tons. This graphic is basically using the waste stream analysis results from Washington State. They go out and study garbage, different sources at different transfer stations, different loads, and they come up with calculations based on material type of what's going into the land, into the trash and ultimately the landfill. And so food is the biggest component of that organic slice of the pie. And when we extrapolate kind of their percentages against the tons we have here in Clark County, we come up with basically 60,000 tons of food waste that are going in the landfill. Our series focuses primarily on that highlighted 20,000 tons, the inedible food waste. We like to call that kind of the fruits, vegetables, coffee, tea, and eggshells. So stuff that could go in a worm bin primarily, or a compost bin, or be managed without major issues. You start adding the meats, the cheeses, the dairies, the oils, the greases, and then you kind of have a different story. So these are the workshops that we offer. We've gotten through our first four, which really focus on the organics piece, and had our fourth one last night. We've got four more coming up, more on keeping hazardous chemicals out of our homes, and then also trying to make sure no garbage goes in the recycle cart. And so those are kind of our three main key messages as a program. And so we try to stress that in our workshops as well. And we've had very good success getting the word out. It's a real positive message into the community. Folks are receptive to this message. We are very successful getting that out through press releases and then you know, all these different various tools of marketing and promotion. And recently, I don't know if you know, but we made it to the front page of the Columbian above the fold. So that was a pretty good story, and they really did a good reporting on that connection of food waste to greenhouse gas and just basically our messaging of trying to keep food out of the trash. The Reflector also ran a really good story, and this really adds to our exposure out there. You can see in the world of shrinking newspapers, and I know as waste people, that and our recycle blend that we get, newspapers really almost gone away, but surprising, our number of registrants still heard through the newspaper. And we also have a lot of good success at our tabling events. Those would be things like the Old Apple Tree, Home and Garden Idea Fair, farmers markets, where we're out and about promoting our messaging, friends, and then tabling events. And those are kind of our main areas as that folks got this messaging through. And here you can see that in our first four workshops, we had 273 register, over 200 showed up with an 80% show rate, which is pretty exceptional given these were all on Zoom. Folks are kind of burnt out on Zoom. Our upcoming next four workshops, we have some that are in person, so we're kind of at a hybrid level right now. And we just have had exceptional feedback of people really getting this message and really being on board with it. And part of attending these workshops and with our partnership with Ecology through the local Solid Waste Financial Assurance Grant, LSWFA, we've been able to purchase and distribute at no cost compost bins and also worm bins. And so these are actual tools. They're high on they're up on the hierarchy of how we can keep food waste out of the landfill through our home composting. They have diverted, these divert actual pounds of food waste out of the landfill. And also we do trainings out in the field, where we show folks how to actually use the equipment. So we don't just pass it off. Sometimes you'll hear about these one-time sales where folks will just line up with their cars, load the thing in and drive away. This you're getting the webinar information, and then hopefully the field education. And then when you come to pick it up, we have a chance with some final FaceTime one-on-one. We also are doing green clean kits. So that's another way to keep household chemicals out of the landfill. And to date, we have distributed 207 compost bins. Again, these are direct folks that we've surveyed and we'll be tracking their behavioral changes, and 170 worm bins. Our final four workshops coming up are Recycling Done Right, which we partnered with Waste Connections. This will be in person at their Orchard site. Also will be a hybrid, so you can tune in person or online. We are doing in-person green cleaning again to reduce those hazardous chemicals. That'll be at Heritage Farm. We're partnering with Washington State University Cooperative Extension to do a food prevention workshop that might have some cooking with leftovers and basically some tips and tricks on how to keep that food from going to waste. And our final one, I'm working actually with Pierce County, Washington, on low waste living. We go back and forth. We both have a pretty robust community workshop series that we offer, and we support each other. So I've mentioned a couple of these partnerships. City of Vancouver, if folks attend these and they are part of a neighborhood association, and follow up with some of the grant requirements, they can use our webinars and workshops to meet those needs. Pierce County Waste Connections, WSU. Folks that register, we get about 80% of those folks do not opt out. So then we can enlist them as into our Green Neighbors listserv, which is a very good tool for us to get messaging out into the community. So we pick up hundreds of new subscribers each season. We do these twice a year, these workshop series, one in the spring, one in the fall. Also training folks to be able to share worms back. Worms are actually expensive. They're harder to get these days. And if you're giving away 200 worm bins a year, the worm bins we give out are all bedded, have worms in them. They've been fed, and they're ready to roll. And then working these programs through our Le Swiffer grant. So I know I covered a lot of information there. This is our program. We're at clarkcountycompost.org. And, yeah, I'll stop sharing, and we'll take some questions. Yes, Kyle.
So the goal of this program, right, with composting is to reduce methane. And I assume that home composting also creates some methane gas. Can you kind of talk about the differences in methane creation with home composting or, you know, composting facilities versus landfills? And like this, is it a significant difference? Like I have no idea, like what kind of gains we'd be getting by these programs.
Yeah. So good question. So the methane is generated in the landfill mostly because there's zero oxygen. And that results because the trash is dumped and buried every day, and then heavy equipment compacts all the oxygen out of that. And then landfills these days are designed for methane collection. In a home compost bin, there's oxygen. So things hopefully do not ever go to that methane generating stage. There is a potential that carbon dioxide could be given off. You know, it's still a chemical reaction. But in terms of greenhouse gas, it's probably a more neutral impact.
Thanks. I'm just curious about that and what kind of impact we can get by composting versus throwing away. So it sounds like it can be pretty substantial.
Yes, yes. And then home composting, again, you know, really dealing with the fruits, vegetables, you know, coffee, tea, the easier ones. So we are definitely partnering this program and looking at, you know, it's going to take to get to zero food waste. And not everyone can put it in their green cart. Not everyone gets the green cart in our county. It's subscription based. So these are tools, and we need to blend them all together to make it happen.
I got a couple questions, Pete.
Yes.
Where do garbage disposals fit in all of this?
Question. Yeah, so garbage disposals, let me share my screen real quickly because that's a good question. And can you guys see that?
Yep.
The EPA has it right in there. So the avoid in the pink in the top right is send down the drain, landfill, or incinerate. And so that's kind of the last step that we want. And one of those reasons with the garbage disposals, and again, someone who's in the biosolids and wastewater treatment would certainly know more about it, but, you know, they're dealing with a lot of those solids, so they're not looking for more things going down the sewer. There's rats in the sewers. They're not really designed for our food waste.
Plants have a hard time handling food waste.
It's not designed to begin. I can speak from the city's perspective because we have a wastewater treatment plant facility. Mm-hmm. They're not designed to handle food waste. Some modern facilities across the U.S. may be specially designed to integrate a stream like co-mingle food waste to select food waste through a disposal. But recall that a wastewater treatment facility is really designed for, borrowing from my colleague, the four P's, puke, and paper, flip paper.
Garbage disposals have been around for
forever.
And the treatment plants seem to be operating quite fun.
They screen them out. Yeah, if you'd like, depending on county staff's availability, you can provide a follow-up from a subject matter expert at the county if you want. I think the city of Tacoma has a wastewater facility that was specially designed to perhaps handle food waste, but as Pete points out, that EPA is modeling and best management practice in that.
I got a second question, Pete, if you don't mind.
Yes, yes.
When do we get to see the Recycle Man show?
I am now moved into the composting guy. So we got to work on that one.
Oh, man. Maybe we can get a cameo.
We should get a cameo.
And we deserve a cameo.
All right, it'll cost you.
I will pay you what the county's paying me.
I'll double that.
Any other questions for Pete? Just want to say well done, sir, and congrats on that article in the Columbian. Quick Google search, just nothing but positive comments on that. So, well done.
Appreciate it. Thank you all.
Yep, absolutely. All right, moving on to item number three, updates. So, solid waste enforcement, Melissa.
Hi, Melissa Sutton, Clark County Public Health, Solid Waste Enforcement.
Back again.
Yeah. Sorry, I just want to make sure that I didn't want to talk on the side and not have other people be able to hear me earlier. So sorry about that. Just a quick update. I sent out the progress report of what we did for numbers. And you're welcome to go through that. The 41 complaints and 42 resolved and 13 inspections and 2 exempt facilities, but I wanted to utilize this time to share with you a little bit about a fun project I've been working on with my colleague Brian DeJonker with the Circle C landfill. Some of you may recall the Circle C landfill is a closed limited purpose landfill, and Brian DeJonker in our office also is under Kimberly, and he has a Brownsfields grant through EPA, and he's in a partnership with City of Vancouver and Vancouver Housing Authority. And they have funds within their grant to allow expansion. And so we have sought EPA approval to do what's called a phase one assessment of Circle C landfill. So where they have Mal Foster as the consultant who will come in, review all of the historical documents, and we did a site inspection. Myself, Brandon Donker, and Emily Hess from Mal Foster looked at all of the site, tried to find old maps from 1978 and maps from 1987 and maps from 1993 and maps from 2022. Some say there's a well here and some it's here and some it's over here. So we tried to find them in real life. Some of them we couldn't find in real life, even though it's on some maps. So we're trying to, through this phase one assessment, we are very hopeful that it will allow for opportunities to have what's called a phase two assessment. So the recommendations that are made in this phase one, like they should add more monitoring wells or more gas wells or everything they've done looks great. Whatever their recommendations are through this phase one, our hope is that we can continue working through EPA's Brownsfields grant to allow what's called the phase two, which is kind of implementation and more design development pieces. Brian DeDonker is really the expert on this, and I'm just working with him to fill in gaps of data from the solid waste side. But it's looking really promising. We are getting the signed access agreement. We have EPA approval. And our hope, our genuine hope, is that through this phase one and potentially phase two, that we can really bring developers to the table and really start implementing some of those changes so that we can get to that elusive pie in the sky termination of post-closure that we have all been waiting for. They initially started conversations in 2015 with our department and their legal counsel and our legal counsel and everyone trying to find with Ecology's guidance documents and find the sweet spots of what's missing. Unfortunately, their financial assurance fund has been depleted since 07. So they have no money. They've exhausted everything. So this was kind of our final dart to try to get them to get to that termination of post-closure. So we're working very closely with the Carlsons, Skip Carlson and Karen Carlson, the children of Carl Carlson, who's passed away, and his wife passed away earlier last year. So trying to work with the family and move forward on this Circle C to hopefully get them to termination of post-closure. When and if that comes about and all of that data, certainly I will bring that forth with SWAC and let you share in that and be a part of that. And obviously, if it came to the point of termination of post-closure where we say you have met all of the terms and conditions, Ecology has given their stamp and they approve this as well and support this activity and we support this and you no longer have to have a solid waste handling permit for your closed facility. So that's our hopeful end game. This is, it's a long time coming, but very exciting to be on this forefront and have this opportunity be open to them, as historically they have been generators of the waste, even though they kind of got dumped on this property from family, but being that it's been kept in the family, they're the generators, and so they don't qualify necessarily for grants. So through this partnership and this once-in-a-lifetime for them opportunity to be able to partake where the government agency is the grant recipient and able to do this to benefit the community and do better for the community is incredible. So I'm really excited for this glimmer of hope for the family. I know that they've been having this landfill and trying to terminate post-closure for at least 8 years that I've been working with them, but they've been really struggling financially for over 15 years to just try to keep up on the monitoring and trying to keep up on the maintenance. And so I'm excited for this, opportunity for them to kind of bring closure on this. So I'm excited. So that's exciting news that's happening in our program that we've been able to collaborate within our department and within other opportunities to try to better the community as a whole. So, yeah. Does anyone have any questions? Or I didn't want to take up too much time. I didn't. So thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
All right, solid waste operations, Joelle.
So I sent a ton of our updates out through email, so I don't want to go over them all here. But just in the last 3 months, we're doing a lot with the solid waste management plan. Been working with Moll Foster. You're going to hear from Sean from Moll Foster later today. I've been attending. In August, I spent a lot of one-on-one time with each of our city public works directors. Then September, I spent a lot of time going to either work sessions, council sessions, just doing a lot of outreach to start talking about transfer station ownership, talk about the solid waste management plan. And then in October, we got, we closed our public comment button that we had online. I mentioned that in my email. And we will be opening that up once we have the preliminary draft finished. So I'm excited for you all to see the work that Moll Foster has done on the new design. And I'm also excited for our next presenter, who I got to meet in person when I was in Boston at Swana. Sean from Calder Recycle, so a lot of work on our battery project is happening as well.
What is SWANA?
Solid Waste Associate.
Sorry.
I can't think about it. I'm like on the spot. I don't know. I was just there alone. Solid Waste Association of North America.
All right.
I'm like, that's been a long day.
Yeah. I think we all put you on that one. Awesome. Thanks, Joelle. All right. Solid Waste Education Outreach, Sarah.
Hi, everybody. I just have a few updates for you tonight. Following up on Pete's presentation about the success of our fall workshops. So just as a reminder, Solid Waste Education and Outreach, we have our four core programs, the Composter Recycler, Green Neighbors, Green Schools, and Green Business programs. And I did want to chime in earlier, but I didn't say anything. I've really been encouraging Recycle Man to retire so that he can focus on being Captain Compost, because he's really, Pete's been so successful in the community recently. And there's a lot of activity around composting, and, you know, we're generating a lot of interest with our programs. So it's a pretty exciting time to be alive doing residential composting outreach. So I'm sort of leaning towards Captain Compost these days, but, you know, he's free to do what he wants. So in addition to that, from some of the other programs, on October 22nd, the Green Neighbors program held a workshop on food waste prevention, and it was about cooking with leftovers. And we were able to partner with the WSU Extension SNAP Ed program and rely on their expertise in food safety and preservation to really provide the tips and tricks for reducing food waste from your home kitchen. So that's pretty exciting, and we're looking at continuing that partnership, because there's an element of that content that we really want to integrate into our workshop series and events and offerings, and want to do it relying on those experts. The Green Schools program has an upcoming event next week. There are 70 students roughly registered to attend the Green School Summit, and so that's an opportunity to really activate the student leaders and green teams of various schools. And this one will be attended by middle and high school students. And there's a separate one for elementary school. And I'm kind of rolling right through this because I don't want to take too much time. We have a lot going on. So in addition, our Green Neighbors program is working on some high-level messaging for the holidays around all things reducing recycling contamination by focusing on kind of the mailers. Everyone does a lot of people do their holiday shopping online. So we really push for education components that speak to what types of packaging is recyclable or not. And then also our Christmas tree recycling, and just promoting the opportunities for having those collected and not thrown away.
All right. Any questions for Sarah?
Oh, I forgot one thing. Can I just add one more thing?
No, you said you're done.
Oh.
I'm kidding.
Well, the Green Business program has relaunched our in-person networking events. And on December 6th, we have an event coming up to focus on sustainability initiatives at small businesses. So I kind of wanted to make that plug, especially, you know, for any, you know, for people you know in the community that have small businesses, that would be a good opportunity to kind of spread the word about what we have going on. And that's our effort to offer an opportunity for businesses to provide peer-to-peer support and share ideas. And we just kind of, we convene the minds and then, you know, focus and share efforts about waste prevention and recycling.
Awesome. Sarah, where's that going to be?
It is at Kindred Homestead in downtown Vancouver.
Okay. And does the county have a social media post at all that we could share on our socials or get out an email blast?
I am so glad you asked. We're a little premature for doing our promotion on that. We'll probably kick that off in the next couple weeks. So stay tuned. But yes, we do share that information on our Facebook and Twitter pages. And maybe Wait. Just for fun, if anyone is interested, the Green Business and Green Neighbors programs offer monthly newsletters. And if you want to just kind of, it's just once a month. We don't bombard anyone. We also send one email a month. That's an invitation to those networking events. So if you just want to stay tuned that way, that's a good opportunity.
Perfect, perfect. Could we get an email out to SWAC when that social media post hits so we can all, if we have social media, get out and share it and kind of promote it as well?
Oh, my goodness. I would so appreciate that. Thank you so much. Yeah, I can definitely send all the info out.
Perfect. I appreciate that. And it's close to my office, so it's a win-win. All right. Anything left for Sarah? Nope. All right. Moving on to City of Vancouver. Julie.
Yeah, sorry. I didn't print my paper, so I'm bringing my laptop. Thank you, everyone. It's great to see you all in person and then virtually, too. So keeping our updates brief, Sarah, thank you for coming. Last month, we mentioned our fall leaves coupon. We actually planned for the fall in the middle of summer. And guess what? It's fall now, and the leaves are beautiful. So we have the fall coupon program for all county residents. Promotion's been wonderful for that. And I mentioned the RFP for yard debris contracts. And so we're engaged with the proposers on the contracts that are to be forthcoming. So by the next SWAC, I anticipate being able to share who the new vendors are, existing vendors would be under the program to serve our needs for yard debris and woody debris disposal. In addition, staff on our team review development plans. A trend in Vancouver, in our community in Clark County, is that it feels like we're growing. And recent announcements where Vancouver was among the top 40 cities in population growth. And we see that in our development pipeline as well. So new development in the city, new residents, new businesses, or existing spaces that are getting remodeled. We've seen that development pipeline of new projects come through for permit review just steadily increase. We're breaking records every year. We've reviewed 550 plans to date in 2023, and last year we reviewed 516 total. So a comparison of where we were this time last year, we've exceeded that. And notable development projects for my team mentioned full block developments and a waterfront, a new type of housing cottage clusters, so increased affordable housing options, denser housing options as well, and then multifamily communities of all shapes and sizes are kind of the culmination of some of those projects we're seeing. And we're working to maintain and plan for some significant improvements along the Main Street corridor downtown, scheduled for construction in 2024. So we're already pre-planning for the impacts to garbage and recycling and what it will look like with a new Main Street downtown. This is the time of year where we talk about solid waste rates for 2024. So we've had two legal ads, in case you read the legal section of the Columbian. On the 18th of October and the 25th, we're required by law to run those twice. And we have a public hearing planned for next Monday. So if you're interested in joining, or if your constituents are in Vancouver and want to know about their garbage and recycling rates, come talk to us or come to the public hearing on Monday evening.
What is the plan?
What is the plan?
Yeah, what's going to happen with the rates?
The rates will be adjusted a range of 5.6, and you can ask us last year. I so appreciate that. The rate adjustment is, it ranges. We have 200 plus rates in our utility rate ordinance. So between 5.3 and 6.9% for the typical single family customer. That is a customer with a 32 gallon cart weekly for garbage, every other week recycling, and a 96 gallon organics cart. That would be a 9.9% increase, or $3.50 per month increase in their bill. And that's subject to city council approval. So they are the rate making authority. And that factors in changes in processing fee, tip fee, customer counts that our service provider experiences changes to. And then other inflationary factors as well, fuel, CPI. So it's our typical season of rate setting. No calls from the legal ads, as much as I really hope for them. Actually, I have one comment that I received from a resident outside of Vancouver. So shifting gears to other work, the SWAC was previously asking about the city's climate action framework. That's a document that our council policy framework, our council adopted last December. And our climate team presented an update 1 year in to our city council in a workshop on October 23rd. So I'll provide a summary of that. They have a new newsletter they're coming out with and a fall edition that just was launched if you were interested in tracking that. And then unrelated to solid waste, but sort of, is the city's launched a new brand. You probably can't see from far. It's a new logo. Same city, new appearance, right? A new representation. But As part of that, the city launched a new website in September, and a lot of research and work went into evaluating our other website that we had before. And one of the really interesting facts was that the research team found that a significant number of statistically valid, I guess, clicks were made for garbage and recycling. So the public is very interested in the topic of garbage and recycling. So embedded within our website is intentional design and functionality to find garbage and recycling information. And then from there, with the new format, we'll work to continually improve our web pages. So I'll include the link to our website there. And we're going to hopefully put some new rates information on that site as well. Yeah. So the logo will be phased in. It was only recently announced this week. So get a fresh preview, perhaps, more than some. But with that, I'll wrap it up and ask if y'all have questions or clear your mind.
With the rate, that was, first off, by commendation, whoever printed that page, because you had a gazillion different rates on
it. Yeah, I get to work with a Colombian and hand them a lovely gift.
But the, does the city get any revenue back from recycled revenue?
From the sale of recyclables that are processed by CRC. So it's split three ways between CRC, the recyclables processor, the county, and Vancouver under the terms of the contract of the disposal and recyclables processing contracts. And we have to use that revenue to then buy down the cost of service for the city of Vancouver.
Oh, okay.
It is a shrinking fraction of the value retained by our entities as we split it three ways. But the city has long opted to take that, any revenue earned, to then buy down the cost of the service for recycling collection.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Helpful?
Yes, because the revenue fluctuates.
Mm-hmm. Commodity
and,
value.
And now the technology is changing where we can actually generate more revenue based on capturing more recyclables to remarket. And I was just curious how that financial relationship was structured.
Under the terms of the contract, the county's the lead agency. CRC is party to the city's party to it, and CRC is the processor of recyclables.
Yeah. So, thank you.
So helpful. Great. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. All right, moving on to Waste Connections. Derek, you're up, bud.
Good evening. Thanks for having me. Let's see, on our collection side of the business, we just completed a contract extension with the City of Battleground. They had chosen to leave the collective program with the county and go it on their own, the driving force being that they wanted to maintain weekly recycling service. So we have negotiated a new recycling contract for them that will run for 8 years and allow them to maintain weekly recycling service at a premium price above what everybody else is paying in Clark County. We're actively preparing for the winter season. We always love the snowfall and the canceled services, and so we do everything we can to try and make sure all of our communication tools are sharpened and ready to go. All of our drivers are trained properly, and we can have a successful winter. Hopefully we won't have too much snow on the valley floor this year, but you never know. Inevitably, we miss a lot of customers up in the foothills as the snowfall starts, and they're usually pretty used to it, but it can get pretty rigorous up there. Other things on the collection side, we are all the way through the completion of the automation of what we call the UTC service areas. That would be the urban growth area, rural, Battleground, Le Centre, and Yakult. All have garbage carts now instead of cans. That was a 2-year project that we automated those routes. We did a large reroute, as you remember, last year, which caused a lot of joy amongst customers, moved days around, but everything's settled down quite nicely at this point. The rollout actually went fairly well. We had some challenges with acquiring trucks. The trucks that were supposed to be here in March just finally showed up. We're still actually 2 trucks short. I apologize. We haven't received all of the 14 trucks we ordered yet, so we've been kind of hodgepodging things together with trucks from other sites. But that went pretty well. And then we've had a lot of customers, a lot more than we thought, upsized from 32 to 64 gallons. So they previously had a Home Depot, round can, and they would put out an extra bag or two every once in a while. Well, they're finding that their 32-gallon cart, even though it's the same volume, is configured a little bit differently, and they're probably having some trouble fitting all their garbage in there, or they're just not wanting to put out the extra material. So they're upsizing to 64, so we've had a significant number of customers doing that. They ran through our extra inventory, so we've been having to actively order additional carts for people to make sure they all have it. But in general, that's all through, which will be nice to get into the holidays with the new system all set. On the transfer station side, we've said this all year, but volumes for 2023 are going to be down about 2% garbage tons. So total tons will be down about that much. Traffic's down about the same. So it's actually been a bit of a ability to take a deep breath this year after some of the steep inclines we saw the previous years. Recycling, so curbside recycling tons are down about 5% year over year. So certainly a sluggish economy out there that's driving that. Outbound markets in general for commodities are strong, so all the material we're bringing in, we're sorting, baling, and moving out to end markets with no issues there. Pricing is, as Julie indicated, it's been slipping for quite a while. From what I'm hearing, we're kind of at a high point right now, which is cardboard selling at about $100 a ton, and cardboard in previous years had usually been up in the 200s. But now we kind of sell around $100, and from what we're hearing, we'll probably get through the holiday season at $100, and then it may start to erode again down from $100. So it's going to be interesting to see where those commodity markets wind up in the years ahead. We also had the state legislative tours last month at West Van, so we were able to give, I think it was about 8 or 9 of our state legislators and senators a tour of the recycling facility and talk about just some of the solid waste issues that we're having here in Clark County. There was a day when the City of Vancouver wastewater treatment plant was down, so we had some lovely smelly material from there, so they really got a good sense of what the industry's like in realistic terms. And I think they actually appreciated kind of seeing, you know, what our staff go through, what people do to try and move solid waste through the system, which was nice. A lot of discussion about the bottle bill. Monica Stonier, who's one of the local representatives, is one of the chief proponents of the new bottle bill that's going to be making its way through the legislature. And so we had a lot of discussion with that. They were very interested in feedback on our thoughts on how that would impact our business and then the local economy in general. And so we were able to have good discussions on that. And then the last thing I would say is we have our annual bike build coming up, which we're very excited about. So Waste Connections every year. Some of you guys have been able to participate in it. We build about 1,000 bikes for kids in the community. It's a great event. It goes over 2 days. Cindy Holloway on our staff spearheads the event, and it's an amazing time. We do an employee build on Friday night, and then we do a larger community build on Saturday. And it's an all-day affair, like I said, and we'll deliver those bikes to kids in the community starting mid-December. The employee event is scheduled for December 8th, and then if anybody on SWAC wants to attend, the community event's on the 9th on that Saturday, and I'm sure Presser will be there, and we'll have a good time. So good time to have Elle. That's all I got.
All right, thanks, Derek. Any questions for Derek?
When do we get our first electric garbage truck? Portland's got theirs.
So Portland got City of Roses in Portland has ordered a Peterbilt. I believe it's a roll-off truck because they don't do any residential collection. We have worked with a company called Lion Enterprises in the Northeast to try and build a route truck. They have not had success yet carrying a full day's load of charge. So the trucks that they built can only go 4 hours. Peterbilt is working on a truck. They have asked us to sign a PO for next year to purchase one of these side load trucks, but we still have not seen any of their versions make it through a day as well. A roll-off truck could be a little bit different. It's obviously not generating as much power, So it allows for, you know, a lighter load and a lighter electrical load. And so I think that's what City of Roses purchased and they're going to be utilizing. We could probably go get a roll-off truck. It's just not a primary chunk of the business that we do. And we think a residential truck is the one that we really want to perfect. But the Peterbilt team that we work with has kept us in the loop to this point about what's going on with the development of those trucks. And as far as I've heard, they're getting further. They're just not able to make it through a day.
So I work for the Wackanot Food Drive. Have you heard of that?
Mm-hmm.
Donner is going to provide an electric tractor to haul one of our trailers.
Hmm.
So they got one as part of a PR. I don't know how much. I'm going to ask them. I don't know how long they can run it. This is going to be pretty light use. It'll be interesting to see it.
Yeah, it's. I know Daimler's doing a lot of work with electric vehicles, and I mean it's coming. It's just a matter of when they finally get that technology. It's just the reality of hauling around 7 to 10 tons of garbage and that gross vehicle weight that's required to, you know, just the power to make it through a day is just different than a lot of the other applications that they're using EVs for right now.
Very cool.
Any other questions?
Yeah, Derek, I have one. First off, congratulations to your company on the great press out of Cleveland and your new Murph out there. It had some interesting aspects to it that look like we might have some opportunities here. The question specifically is the technology that they address there, and as your company perfects the whole MRF operation, how much of that will be incorporated in what you project as the replacement MRF here?
Well, that's a good question, Mike. I think it's hard to say right now just because I don't know how much I can say at this point, but I mean, we've had discussions about what a future MRF might look like in Clark County. You're probably looking 2 to 3 years out on a new MRF at the soonest, depending on contract status and agreements and everything else, which are moving very slowly right now. So 2 to 3 to 4 years. So what's being built right now is not what's going to be built necessarily in 2 to 3 to 4 years. So for me to say, you know, the technology that's out there right now is going to be representative of what we'll have. Whatever we build in 4 years will be better than what they just, you know, released. That's the pace and the speed the technology is working at right now. It'll have a lot of the same elements. It'll have optical sorters. It'll have robotic arms. It'll have a really high yield of material. You know, every new iteration of those facilities is generating, you know, a better sort, a better yield, and hopefully maybe an opportunity to, you know, add additional materials to the flow that we just don't even know about right now. So whatever they're building right now, whatever's out there, it'll just be 4 years better, you know, down the road. But it'll look somewhat the same, I suppose.
Thank you.
Anything else for Derek? All right, just one last plug for the Scott Campbell Christmas Promise, December 9th. Starts at 9 a.m. at the Clark County Event Center at the Fairgrounds. Absolutely a phenomenal event. If you've never been a part of it, if you need to get in the Christmas spirit, or if you have young ones, kids, grandkids, anything like that to get in the Christmas spirit, definitely show up. Realize that it's about giving to someone else that's in need, because that's exactly what this event is. And just the outpouring of community support is tremendous. I wish Cindy would change the date, because it always happens to be the morning after my company holiday party, so I'm always there a little rough. But main event's there, free breakfast burritos, free hot chocolate, coffee, Santa's there. It's just an overwhelming support from the community, which is awesome to see. So definitely we can make.
And Jason, just a reminder that people that may not know, Scott Campbell was a long time member of the community, a long time member of the SWAC group as well. Sat on SWAC for many years and attended as a representative of CRC, and so he was heavily invested in the solid waste industry in Clark County for a long time.
Absolutely, thank you. All right, moving on, battery training and discussion. Sean.
Hi guys. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. So my name is Sean Finian with Call to Recycle. I love these conversations. I actually came from the hauling side. And, you know, I've been in sustainability and divergence. So these conversations are near and dear to my heart. I'm in batteries now. I'm 4 years into it with Call to Recycle. And before I start the presentation, I'll meander through the slides, but please, if you have questions about a topic I've touched on, just talk over me. I won't take offense to it. I promise. All right. Let me see how to share the screen here. I'm a team guy. Share screen. There. Can we see that?
Not yet.
There it is.
Perfect. So I'm a program manager with Call to Recycle. We've broken it up to East. So we're in U.S. and Canada. We're a nonprofit in U.S. and Canada. We're broken up into the East and the West. U.S., that's me. I'm the West. So I have some slides. I'll go over kind of who we are, what we do, kind of current state of battery recycling, some best practices and kind of future state where we're seeing the market and the industry go. So I mentioned we're a nonprofit. We were started in the mid-90s. The EPA kind of came after the battery industry for landfilling, and back then it was all NiCad. There was mercury. That was a no-no. So the industry got together and created RBRC, I think was the name, which was funded to help states recycle batteries and come up with a program to make it easier. We're funded primarily by battery stewards and manufacturers. In the U.S., it's voluntary, and that's an interesting financial model. And in Canada, we run the program there, and it's EPR, right? It's funded on the front end, and it's a different model. I'm not going to say which one is best, but we definitely have our challenges on the voluntary side of it. As we know, recycling is expensive, and as a result, we've come up with some fee-based services as well to kind of address what's happening in the market now with batteries. So our purpose, I'm going to go off script here. I really think our purpose is to make the challenging battery landscape easier to manage for folks. You know, it's for such a small, innocuous little item, batteries are confusing. And a lot of people don't know, even myself, I'm in the industry, don't know what gets recycled, what goes where, what to do with batteries, what type of battery chemistry. Really, our job is to manage that complexity and make it easier, I think, as they become more, as they infiltrate the market more and more. But we get, as an organization, we're judged by how many batteries we take out of the landfill. That's our goal, batteries out of the waste stream. Just a quick overview. I know it's probably impossible to see this. It is for me. I don't have my glasses on, but we work with manufacturers and stewards. They fund a little bit of money for each gram they sell into the marketplace. The consumers then purchase batteries, recycle them. We collect the batteries through different avenues. It goes to sorters. The sorters will take, so we don't actually own any property. We don't sort, touch batteries. We manage the process cradle to grave, but the sorters will kind of separate out the chemistries and send those out to the processors, depending on where they're at in the U.S. And then that gets broken down into black mass or other products that can be recycled into new batteries or cell phones or whatever. That's kind of what we do, our purpose. So specifically for our program, we're about 8 million pounds of batteries a year. I have heard a metric that in the U.S., only about 12% of the batteries get recycled, so not a lot. And I don't know, can you see, I have my screen up, but the bulk of batteries that are recharged, that are recycled or rechargeable, single-use, the alkaline, it used to be primarily alkaline, NiCad, and then that's shifting with the landscape of battery products, bikes, power tools, cars. That's going to more rechargeable chemistries we're seeing. So specifically for Washington State and Clark County, again, this is just through our program. So Clark County year to date has recycled 400 or 500, 600 pounds of batteries. And Washington State, over 200,000 pounds of batteries. And that's, again, that's just the rest. There are other avenues that accept batteries. So as I mentioned, you know, our program up until about 3 years ago is basically you would call us, we would send you a free box, and then you'd send the box in full of batteries. And that was the job. Companies would invest with us on the stewardship side and get a seal saying they have a responsible recycling program. That's what we did. That was our core mission, but that's changed. The type of battery, it's gone from nickel and the mercury containing batteries to lithium primary, the lithium ion, all the rechargeable. So our business model had to shift as well. So now we have set ourselves up to provide a solution, not just from consumer batteries. And our delineation is kind of consumer batteries up to 300 watt hours. And when we talk about legislation and kind of stewardship programs, most consumer business models are up to 300 watt hour for batteries. That's kind of our line. But we're seeing, you know, a ton of high watt hour batteries, EVs, e-bikes. We just signed an agreement with People for Bikes, which is an organization for the e-bike community. And we've started a U.S. collection stewardship program just for e-bikes. Phones, cars, we've just entered into an agreement with Ascend to handle EV batteries. So really we're positioning ourselves to help consumers recycle the smallest battery all the way up to EV packs. And that was just in the response to what we've seen. So a lot of what we focus on is how do we get the message out? You know, education and legislation are kind of the nomenclature. Education is a huge component of it. How do we change from throwing it in the batteries like in the garbage like my kids do still, to stopping putting it out on the bin or taking it into a Home Depot or HHW? You know, how do we? What's an effective way to do this? And that's challenging. We all deal with that regardless. You know, composting is the same challenge. So current state, batteries are batteries, batteries. A lot of the issue we deal with is everybody, or a lot of people on the consumer side just see a battery as a battery, right? They don't denote the different chemistry, size, threat level for a thermal event, which I understand. Again, I'm in the industry and it's confusing to me. So we spend a lot of time trying to educate folks on alkaline primary versus rechargeable, terminal protection, how to dispose of them. Education and awareness, it can't be one time, it has to be consistent. And this is stuff we all know, especially in this group, even on the solid waste side, you have to consistently pound home the message of recycling, the safest way to do it, how to do it, the easiest way to do it, and education. So we go out and we meet with folks and organizations to start early. This is something that we think is effective. And then ultimately, you're not going to satisfy everyone. We've seen, as I'm sure you guys know, that really the focus on recycling are on the coastal states. We're really heavy on the East and West Coast, Middle America. Not as interested. It's expensive, and I just don't think there's a culture of recycling for the most part. I don't want to stereotype or generalize. And really, it's just not about saving the planet anymore. It's a bigger issue. And for me, it's a collection and safety issue. You know, these batteries, especially at the high watt hours, are dangerous. And Derek, I know that you all just had a truck fire, and MRF fires are bad. I worked at Recology, and the MRF burnt down in California, and it just, these things get out of control quick. So for us, the safety factor is a huge component, as well as making it easy to recycle. We do some programs, and this is we have bandwidth for this to partner with folks. So if Clark County wanted to do this, or if individual folks wanted to get involved with this, we have Avoid the Spark, which is about around battery safety. It's a campaign. There's media, there's social media, and there's in-market activation. We did this in a few states and with a few municipalities, and really focused around safety. And when the boxes came in and our drums came in, we did an audit, and we saw a marked difference between before and after campaign. So education does work. And as I mentioned, education and legislation is the path forward, right? So 1896 passed in Washington. That's going to change the landscape for those of us who collect waste streams, specifically in the battery world. We just signed the stewardship program. We're administering that in D.C. That came out yesterday or Tuesday. I can't remember, but we think that California is going to align with that. Washington State, really a managed stewardship program funded. Well, each state's a little different, but stewardship involvement, funding from the producers. There's still a talk around that for Washington. So really, we want to just simplify collecting batteries and recycling them and safely getting them out of the waste stream and reused. And that's it. That's all I have for batteries. Any questions?
Got one. On the education area, you mentioned that the producers are considering participating. The producers are the ones that are creating the lithium batteries that have the extreme volatility. Are you working with them at all on labeling and them announcing up front, so when a person buys something that has a rechargeable battery, that the warnings are clearly visible as opposed to small print underneath?
You know, that's a good question. And I don't disagree with you in that they're producing a larger, more powerful batteries. I would argue that the market is asking for this. But then again, you know, you've got California banning gas-powered motors for outdoor power equipment, so the need is there. To answer your question, I don't know. That's a great question, and I think that might be producer-dependent. But I think it's a fair ask. I don't really have an answer to that on the producer, on the OEM side.
Because
that's not something we work with them on, no.
I can add some comment to that. The legislation that passed in Washington included some labeling requirement information in there that will come out in the future. I can't remember the timeline on it, but it's in there.
Oh, good.
They're developing a UL standard for lithium-ion batteries, are they not? At least for e-bikes. They're developing Underwriters Lab is developing standards for it.
You know, that's a great question. We were working with San Francisco on a multifamily program, and one of the sticking points was kind of what lab testing are we going to all agree upon, really, from a safety and litigation perspective, I think. And there really wasn't an agreement, and that was constantly challenged. That's the challenge. Nobody really agrees on one set of data as the governing data that I've seen yet.
Because there was a thing recently in New York City, their e-bike that you can, I guess it's free use or it's general use. You belong to an association, you can pick up these bikes. The fires in New York City of the lithium batteries on these bikes that are randomly positioned just around the community as they're used has become a big problem. And it also is a huge problem in commercial aviation. And here are these companies producing this thing that has such a fire hazard to it. And they don't seem to have any ownership of the risk. Once they sell it, it's kind of like your problem. And it's the more I learn about it, the more frustrating it becomes that they don't take ownership for what they're producing.
Yeah, UL 2271 and UL 2849. It's a way for consumers to know that their e-bike batteries and electrical components are safe. The certification helps minimize fire risk and includes a review of the electrical drivetrain system battery and charger.
And that's all on e-bikes?
For e-bikes and e-bike batteries, which are the big heavy-duty lithium-ion batteries.
Yeah, we worked with New York on that problem. They have up to two fires a day just in residences for e-bikes. And then you've got these e-bike scooter farms that they're charging these illegally. It's a real problem. I think that the power of these little hand grenades, these mini hand grenade batteries, kind of snuck up on folks. and the safety component wasn't looked at, but it's something that we're working on. That was part of our agreement with People for Bikes is the OEM, much like our consumer battery program, the OEMs pay a little money, and if you buy this specialized mountain bike that's part of the program, you can take the battery into participating dealerships and get it recycled for free.
You know, along that education mode, the techniques that people use to put out battery fires seems to be all over the map. It would be nice if there was an association of, you want to call it fire safety or handling. I mean, Tesla, they recycle all their own batteries and build them back into their cars, but I got to believe that they've got hazardous control or fire control procedures that wouldn't be compromising the detail of their product to share their safety procedures. And there's various approaches, and doesn't seem to be no place to go where you get something reliable that could put out a lithium battery fire. I'll put it that way. I can't go to
I interrupted.
If you know something.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue you could come to us on that. I toured Tesla for that specific problem, and they have their own fire department. It's pretty amazing what Tesla has done out there, a small city. But we have a solution that we work with a company called CellBlock, and it's a thermal mitigation base change material, and it's really been a game changer in the fire safety environment. It's allowed us to collect batteries in bulk without sorting or taping, kind of mixing with this substrate. It's really taken away the complexity of figuring out what battery goes where. And it's a pretty amazing solution. I'd suggest to look at CellBlock EX online. They've got videos. It's a pretty amazing fire suppression tool. But you're right, there is nothing standardized, correct?
Where's Fireman Kyle? He'd be way in there.
I was in a training recently with NAMA, which is North American Hazardous Materials Association, and fire department in that town gave a presentation, and kind of I got the impression that the fire response for lithium ion batteries is kind of up to department by department, that they develop their own strategies and they're constantly evolving because they just learn more every time they try and put out a car fire and that type of thing. And there is some progress compared to, 5 years ago, but you're right. It is challenging to put out a lithium ion fire on all fronts. So.
Yeah, it's constantly evolving, and these batteries are getting, bigger and stronger.
But I think to go back to what Mike was saying, and appreciate what you said, Sean, but there was really no public education on how to handle it if you come across it, if it happens in your, if you're on a bike or it's at your house, or if you come across it, how do you handle it, right? And
correct.
Going back, correct. That's the problem we're facing. And then going back, that each fire department has kind of their own procedures and how to deal with it. Interesting times, scary times, but I know everyone's doing their best to come up with the best solutions.
It seems like manufacturers are distancing themselves from participating in the effort to come up with a good solution.
The model for the Washington legislation is producer funded, so the manufacturers of batteries will be required to fund the recycling program, and still early in that process at Ecology, but the goal collection start date would be July 2027. That's the date that I remember. So we're still a few years out from being able to drop off batteries at sites, which is why we're operating the Clark County drop-off program just until then. So, yeah, right now, filling in the gap, but in 2027, it'll be producer-funded, which is good news for Washington.
Absolutely. Well, that seems to go in track with all of technology advances, technology advances and we got to figure out how to deal with it, that always lags further behind on the waste standpoint. Yeah. All right. Any other questions for Sean?
I just was going to add in, this is Laura with Ecology. I just wanted to add in, I looked it up here, and the marking of the batteries to identify the chemistry of it and indicate that it shouldn't be disposed of in household waste is beginning January 1, 2030. So even a little further out, just for your information.
That's way far. All right. Thank you so much, Sean. I just do have one thing to say. Saw that jersey behind your shoulder there. Go Hawks, baby. Go Hawks. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Of course.
All right. Now on to solid waste management plan. Sean from Mall Foster.
So we have another Sean, and I did send just some updates via email, but Sean Henderson is here from Mall Foster. We started working on our contract with Mall Foster in July. We have a small work group that works with Sean as we've been going through the design process, and I'm really excited for him to give this presentation. He's going to go through our process with how we landed on the new design, and you get a little sneak peek of what the new one's going to look like. So welcome, Sean.
Thank you. I'm Sean. I work at MFA. I'm a graphic designer here. I'm on the design communications marketing team, but we also have a whole bunch of subject matter experts that have written these plans. So as a designer, it's great to have that knowledge that I could pull into this project and really help us streamline things and keep me aware of things that I should be aware of and help us come up with solutions. So my plan is to just kind of share our process and what we've done so far. Feel free to interrupt with any questions. We'll just get started. So we started this process with our visual preference survey, and we just used this on, especially with new clients and new projects, to kind of collect as much information as we can about the project and the organization when we get started. That way we're not just diving into something and coming up with a couple directions that we feel look really good but really aren't going to work. So we sent these out to the team, collected all the brand elements, brand guides. We took a look at other solid waste management plans that the team really liked. We collected as much information about the project as we could. And then we kind of got into these mood boards to kind of narrow down the style that the team was after, that we thought would work well for the plan. And we kind of grouped them into these different segments, like minimal, geometric, organic, bold, just really dial in on a certain area that we thought would work well, so we're not wasting a ton of time in revisions, getting the plan to look really good. We're hitting the ground running with exactly what the team wants and getting good visual direction from the start. And one thing that came up during this process was the need for photography. So as we looked at other plans, we noticed that they were using full image photography that looked really good, that broke up the text, and we wanted that in the plan. So we were able to go out across Collette County, hit up multiple sites, and take a bunch of photos. This one is kind of the early fan favorites. We like it because it shows kind of Collette County in the background. It's got the transfer station in the background, and it's got the barge lines in front. But we took over 3 days, we took 600 photos that can all be, that we could pull from to use throughout the plan, but also that Clark County could use in other channels as well. So social media, updating the website, hopefully this is just a good library that the team could pull from going forward. And then from that visual preference survey, we were able to very quickly just flesh out a couple of directions based off of the feedback in the survey. So we went after this minimal stylescape and then also a more organic stylescape. And these are kind of just real quick iterations to show what different things could look like tables, body copy, image treatments. And we got, usually a lot of times there's a lot of debate on this, but this was the team overwhelmingly, chose the minimal stylescape to proceed with some other direction in there, but it was nice having such a clear consensus on that. And then from the feedback on that, we were able to come up with two drafts that are really dialed in into that minimal aesthetic and start getting the layout done. And when we're laying this out, we're really focused on making this as readable as possible and but also as accessible as possible, so as many people as possible can read this easily. So things that we're taking consideration are font sizes, hierarchy, being consistent throughout the document, stuff like line length and justification all plays into that readability of the text. That's something we're focused on. And then also color contrast and making sure that our tables and charts and figures are all colorblind friendly, and we're using stuff that's getting the data across simply. And then we're also including things like navigation aids, so it's easy to tell where you're at throughout the document, hyperlinking things. We're developing a robust table of contents and index, so it'll be easy to update and manage going forward. And so we got these two directions, and let's see, we got some of that photography in there. We're using these large hero images kind of as section breaks to kind of break up the content before we get into the content. And then we're also taking a look at the tables. This is one of the things that was called out as we got started with the project, that being able to manage this and update it going forward is going to be a big priority. So we went after a couple different levels that we could attack this and make these easy to update going forward, but also making sure that they're looking good and getting the information across. So we have this one, which is done very easily in Illustrator, that would be easy to manage. But then we also looked at a font that allows us to manage all the data within InDesign itself, and which would be much easier to update for the team going forward. And this is just a font that they would have to type in the numbers, and then it spits out this data. And so right now we're at the point where we've gotten good feedback on these directions. My team knows which way to run with this, and we're getting into laying out the full plan and just managing the content as it comes in and continuing to provide feedback and come up with systems to make this easy to manage going forward. So is there anything I missed, Joelle, that you wanted me to touch on?
I think you did a good job. Would you mind just sort of flipping through each version really quick too? Because I think when you were going through it, it was a little bit hard to see. So.
Of course, yeah, I'll start. So this is the first option. And this one was just focused on being as minimal as possible. So we used very little textures. We have this full bleed image to break up the chapters. And then just one column with wide margin, so it's very digestible. Line length is something I talked about, something that's usually about 13 to 17 words in length is the easiest to read before it gets tiresome on the eyes. And then this is the second one, which brought in a few more color changes and textures in the backgrounds, and then played with not the full bleed images, but starting content within those chapter breaks.
Thank you so much, Sean.
I'm impressed.
All right. Any questions for Sean?
You mentioned in 2 meetings ago we were talking about the plan. With all the, actually the second page, it showed governmental agencies, and there was a discussion about a fold-out org chart that was going to show the relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Is that type of characteristic?
We're working with Sean on some of that feedback. So I did send out SWAC comments. You could see. I left it anonymous, but just so you all could kind of see what each other commented on. And then part of our work as we keep working with Mal Foster and work with Sean is to have some of those diagrams or some of the data reported in a way that we got comments feedback back on.
Okay.
So that will be something that,
might be included.
Mm-hmm. And we can talk about it when we get to that place, when we're commenting on the preliminary draft. So the draft that you all commented on was the pre-preliminary draft. And now we're working with Sean to have the full preliminary draft. And part of being able to submit that draft to Ecology, we have to have all the interlocal agreements signed with the city. So that's part of that package before it can actually be submitted for review. So we're hoping that those all get moved along quickly. But the work that we're doing with Mal Foster is just wonderful. And it's going to make it a lot easier for us to manage revisions, manage edits, having those navigations on the pages. That way when there's comments submitted, we know exactly which page to go to. Mal Foster is helping us with a process to be able to manage change in the document and be able to train our staff to manage change for future updates too. So there's so many fantastic things that we're doing with this project just in terms of having the document function for us electronically. So. And we have fun. These are fun.
Any other questions for Sean? No. All right. Great work.
Thank you all.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
All right. Moving on to other business. Going once. Anyone have other business? Going twice. All right, public comment. Any public comment? Going once, going twice. All right, I consider this meeting adjourned.
Thank you
all for being here. Thank you all for being online.
Nice to see you.